On the Nonlinear Healing Podcast, we talk about all the aspects of healing. The beautiful parts and the painful parts, too. We acknowledge that healing is not linear, and there are many ups and downs in every person's story. And in fact, we celebrate the messy parts just as much as the pretty parts. This is Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Nonlinear Healing Podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Brooke. I am so grateful that you've decided to tune in to this podcast. It is a project that is near and dear to my heart. The idea for it came at a very special time and a very pivotal moment for me, and everything about it has just lined up perfectly. I feel so in alignment, and I am so incredibly excited to see where this project takes me. The idea for this project came to me during my work at the hospital. For those of you who are not familiar with me, I am a social worker, I am a therapist, I work inpatient in a hospital setting on a psychiatric unit, and I work with a lot of people who are at their darkest moment and experiencing what is probably one of the worst periods of their life. And during this work, I, of course, have to be their hope and help to guide them towards the light. And oftentimes, what I found was I would have patients who would say things like, "Oh, that's great, and I'm so glad that you know people who've healed and that you've healed, but I can't heal. I'm not one of those people. I have too much that I've done wrong. I am too broken. I am too old. I am too stubborn. I am too this or too that." So I know from my work, and I come from a diverse background. I've worked anywhere from 3-year-olds up to 103 was my oldest patient ever. And I have seen healing all across the lifespan. I have seen it across all of the classes, rich, poor, everything in between. Healing is spontaneous, and healing happens in the right conditions. It's not this big internal thing that some people have and some people don't. And I want people to have evidence of this. I want people to be able to go somewhere and see proof that healing can come to anybody at any given time. And so that's what I want this podcast to be. When people come to me and say, "I can't because X, Y, or Z," I want to be able to pull up an episode and say, "Here is so-and-so with this exact same predicament, and look at what they were able to do." Now, this is not to downplay or to say that people's life circumstances are not relevant or that they're not important. Of course, people come to healing in their own time. And everybody's suffering is valid. And it is, of course, important that we honor and recognize where we are suffering. But I also think that simultaneously, we can both endure some amount of suffering and also heal. I don't view this as an either or. And I think that a lot of people, we try to make it black or white in our minds. We're either healing or we're sick. And the truth is that there's all this gray space. There's this middle place, the place that we don't talk about. And yes, I think that for those of us who have found the light and are continuously working on ourselves, we trend up, right? If you think about healing on a graph, there may be a slight incline, right? But at the same time, there are going to be days where we are waning a bit, right? There are going to be days where it is difficult to get through, and we may find ourselves slipping into survival mode at times, but Sometimes we need survival, and sometimes we need thrival, and being able to switch between and among these states is a beautiful thing that can only happen if we recognize and see the gray space for what it is. So, I hope that you find these stories inspiring. I hope that they bring you a peace and a hope that you may not have had before you listen to them. I hope that you're able to find yourself in these stories, to hear your own stories and the stories of recovery. I am so blessed and so grateful to have my own story to share. And I would like to start with sharing my own story. Now, before I get started on my story of nonlinear healing, I should probably tell you who I am. So my name is Courtney Brooke Gabochek. I am a social worker. I am a mental health advocate. I'm a change maker. And I'm a wife and a mom. I'm here to share my story of resiliency because this is a passion project for me. This comes from a place of heart. I am doing this for one reason and one reason only. And that is because I want people to see the way out of the fire. I want people to know that there is hope. I have spent a lot of my life running from my past. I lived in fear of what would happen if people found out who I was, where I've been. But what I found is that most often it is those parts of me that I'm most afraid of that inspire others along their journey. Most of the time, once I finally open up and I share my struggles, share my background, if anything, people have more respect when they see what I've overcome. Sometimes I say to clients that our weaknesses are actually our strengths. And what I mean by that is that our weaknesses only have strength over us as long as we don't look at them, as long as we don't face them. But the moment that we do, well, then our weakness becomes our strength. It loses its power. And we have our full strength again. So, I'm done being fearful of what people think about me. People have always thought what they want to think about me. It doesn't matter. I've tried being perfect. I've tried being the goody two-shoes. People still talked about me. I lived on the complete other extreme end where I did whatever the fuck I wanted all the time. People still talked about me. Now I'm in this beautiful gray area and lo and behold, people still talk about me. But you know what? It doesn't matter. I'm being true to me and sharing my story. So, now that I've told you a little bit about who I am, let's do a couple quick housekeeping items before I jump into my story. So what to expect from the podcast? If you can't tell already, I'm keeping it real. This is all about honesty and authenticity. I'm going to be blunt and honest about the human experience because, frankly, not enough people are. This is all about hope. All of the stories you're going to hear are stories of resiliency. They're stories from recovered persons, survivors, and they're designed to inspire other people along their healing journey. This podcast is also meant to be practical. We always leave listeners with the tools and techniques that helped us along the journey. That's key. As far as the structure, each season will be comprised of 12 episodes and a two-part season. So you'll get 6 dropped bi-weekly Mondays starting now in September through November. We'll break for the holidays and we'll be back in March for for bi-weekly episodes again through May. Then, of course, we'll break for the summer and be back for a new season. And now, without further ado, I invite you to take a moment, ground yourself in, maybe take some deep breaths in through the nose and out through the mouth. Maybe I'm just saying this for myself. And ground yourself as you prepare for my story of non-linear healing. So I was born in the early 90s. I'm a 90s baby. Think Rugrats and Jimmy Neutron. Yeah. I was born to two young parents. My dad was a senior in high school. My mom a sophomore in college when they found out they were expecting me. And my dad did the thing that respectable men did back then, which was he went to the Navy. He went into the forces. So my mom, she stayed back in Pennsylvania. I'm from Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh with me and my grandmother and my aunt. And we lived here for a while until my dad asked her to marry him over a letter. And he got leave, he came back, and they got married in the same church that I would later be married in and baptize my children in. The church that the giant sat on in Greensburg. Can't miss it. And I feel like I should preface this entire conversation by saying that all of our parents had to live with and deal with intergenerational traumas, much in the same way that we did. And really, only to know better is to do better. And unfortunately, we really didn't know better until recently. Mental health awareness has even just peaked over the past few years. So when I talk about the things in my past, just know that I don't look back with any type of judgment or hurt or shame or guilt over any of it, because at the end of the day, people are just people and we do the best that we can. So there is no hurt left. I have only love. At any rate, so of course my parents were young. You know, they're early 20s at this point, just trying to establish themselves and, you know, like lots of people do. My dad likes to party. My dad still likes to party. You can't deny it. He'll take a shot right there with you. And that's part of, you know, that lifestyle. So interestingly, I got drunk for the first time when I was 3 years old because my dad threw a party and apparently alcohol did not deter me at that point. As you might imagine, my mom got pretty pissed. It caused a lot of conflict. And at that point, my mom was pregnant with my sister. She just had a little baby shortly thereafter and she got kind of sick of it. So they separated for a little while. And during that time period, unfortunately, one of the people that my mom trusted with us turned out to not be trustworthy. And we were abused for an extended period of time. And of course, there's threatening and things that happen during those time periods that cause you to not say anything to anyone. But fortunately, it ended. It ended very abruptly. And it was to the point where we required hospitalization. And when I give my talk during the nurse residencies, I talk about how meaningful it was to me during that first hospitalization ever in my life, how amazing the nursing staff were, and everybody was so kind to us. And I remember being so taken care of and so held in that moment. But of course, even with the buffer of having wonderful family who just encompassed us. You know, we moved back to Pennsylvania at that point to where my grandmother was. Both of my grandmothers were. And they became a huge part of our lives. We got really close with our aunts, uncles, and cousins. You know, we had all this love and support, but I still had a very significant impact. I was always a very happy child. And after the incident, I kind of lost a part of that in a way. I was a very anxious child. I was always worried. I couldn't participate in things the same way as other children. And whenever I would be approached about why I'd be acting the way that I did, I would just shut down. I remember at one point there was a kid who would tease me about it to the point where I cussed him out. I was like 7 years old. And he was like teasing me because he found out, because the name triggered me, the name of the person who abused us. I would hear the name and I would get triggered. I would shut down and they figured out the name. And so I wrote, "Go to hell," on a piece of paper and passed it to them in class, and I got in trouble. But that's just one example I could think of, you know, how triggers and things popped up for me throughout my life. Of course, something like that happening at such a young age does change you, certainly. But I would be neglectful to mention the positive aspects of the anxiety too. When we moved back to Pennsylvania, my mom became involved in church very heavily, and we became part of a fundamentalist group that some would argue can be somewhat cult-like, especially at the time period that we belonged to it. Very strict adherence to biblical principles, very strict dress codes, you know, women can't preach, still can't preach, aren't allowed to be pastors, aren't allowed to be deacons, you know, those sorts of things. And but at the same time, you know, that offered quite a bit of structure in our lives. And while there were a lot of aspects that didn't feel good to me, and let's be honest, I was always sort of a rebel, right? I was always the maverick in that setting, always questioning things. But bottom line was that I was a wonderful student. I was a great student, an anxious student, a student who studied and read and pretty much didn't do anything other than focus on my grades, essentially school performance aspects. You know, I was privately schooled, and as part of the church school that I went to, we were given ACEs, which were accelerated Christian education, they were called, and they were basically self-taught courses. And I could just fly through these things. Like, I'm telling you, I was doing etymology in like fourth grade or something. It was ridiculous. But like, I was on track to graduate when I was 15 or 16 years old. However, as mentioned, there were some questionable things with the church. You know, at one point, I know they had shown us at a conference abortion videos, like of aborted fetuses, without talking to parents, without getting any type of consent. I couldn't have been older than 11 or 12 years old being shown these types of things. There were definitely instances of bullying. I endured quite a bit of bullying by girls who were deemed very godly, who I assure you were not very godly, not in the sense that I know godliness. And it became pretty evident after a while that we didn't fit in anymore. And at that point we separated from the church. I was just going into the eighth grade. I had just turned 13. I remember very clearly the seventh grade graduation ceremony when the girl who bullied me relentlessly won Christian of the Year award, and I literally walked outside, I grabbed a cookie, I threw it at the church, and I was like, "Mom, I'm never going back in there." And she was just like, "No, you're not. You don't have to." However, the transition from very strict, very sheltered, fundamentalist, self-paced, advanced church school to public schooling. I went to Jeannette, which is just, it's a very small school. I think there were like 80 something people in my graduating class. Very limited resources. It's a very urban setting. So just a very different culture than what I was accustomed to. And, you know, whenever I walked in, I was still very devout in a lot of ways. I had separated from the church because of the people, but I was still devout in my practices and in my beliefs. I still believed things like I needed to remain a virgin until marriage or I would be less worthy. I needed to be prayerful or I wouldn't find a husband. Very real thoughts and beliefs still at that age. Walking into eighth grade, I carried my Bible around with me to classes in hopes that I would attract the right person. So I, of course, had a hard time integrating then into the school. It was difficult for me to make friends. There were people who were kind to me. I would say there were definitely certain people who gave me a lot of support early on and tried to be helpful and kind, but I'd be lying to say that I really felt accepted by the people at the school because a lot of them would say things I didn't understand because there was just such a stark cultural difference. Like I remember this one time, there was like this group of boys who were like teasing me about running a train. I had no idea what that meant. And I'm like talking to my friend in class, like another, like a girlfriend. And I'm like, yeah, these boys, they keep talking about like wanting to hit me with a train or like run over me, like run a train or something on me. And they're just like laughing. And I'm like, what are, you know, just simple things like that. And I knew that I was the brunt of the joke then, you know. And like I said, people have always had a way of talking about me, and I guess in a way I probably made it easy because of how different I was. I stood out so clearly. But after a while, you know, I did start to integrate more fully, and I made a really good friend who really liked this guy, and they were going to the movies, and he had a friend too. And we all went together, and I ended up having my first kiss and ended up, you know, going out again and going steady. And we were serious for quite some time. It escalated quickly. We got pretty serious after a few months. And I, you know, lost my virginity and became really, really deeply involved with this person. However, you know, of course, like I mentioned earlier, we all have demons, and we all have things that we face. One of the ways that some people have learned to express love is through jealousy and possessiveness. And men are often aggressive when they believe things belong to them. And so after a while, verbal altercations became physical altercations. Things escalated very quickly, very, very quickly. And it got to the point where I couldn't do it anymore. My conscience wouldn't allow me. As much as I had a skewed understanding of love from my own experience and my own witnessing of love, I knew that that wasn't right for me anymore. There was something inside me that told me I had to get out of that situation. So I left him in a really pretty terrible way. I we were fighting one day and he had a habit of breaking up with me. You know, we'd fight and it was, oh, we're over. And then, you know, we'd make up and get back together. Well, broke up with me and I decided, all right, I'm going with it. I went to a party for the first time in my life. I had my cousins invite me to go, you know, out to party at a field party. And I said, sure, I'm going to do it. And I went and I got drunk for the first time. I met somebody new and I was, bam, moved on. Met a new guy with a car who was older and got beer all the time. And I was out. And I had somehow over the course of about a year completely shifted in pretty much all of my stances. Now, things didn't end very well when that happened. I ghosted this person and essentially I ended up getting stalked after work and beat up. And it was a very traumatic event. I ended up, you know, taking it to court, got a PFA, did the whole thing. And while I had always sort of struggled with anxiety throughout my life, that was my first real bout with depression. That was the first time that I ever experienced hopelessness to the point where I wasn't sure if there was a point to living anymore. I was the new girl at that school. Like I said, it was a very small school. And, you know, this person played sports, had lots of friends at the school. And I immediately started to endure just relentless bullying, to the point where I ended up with in-school suspensions because I would end up having to scream and cuss people out. Rumors relentlessly spread about me. I never had hardly anybody stick up for me regarding the domestic violence, even though there were points where he had done it in front of his friends. And out of all of them, there was maybe one who ever said a word about any of it. So there was just a void. I just felt so unaccepted and so disregarded. I made a friend group, though, after some time. I did find people that I fit in with, but they were all older. And a lot of them smoked weed very heavily, and started dabbling in some other things too. So that's when I started using other substances. So while I had started drinking after the breakup, it was my junior, senior year that I started trying pretty much anything I could get my hands on at that point. Other than sticking a needle in my arm. I especially had issues with pills, and I really spiraled pretty quickly with that. It got to the point where withdrawal complicated my depression so badly that I no longer wanted to be alive. And at 17 years old, I had a superficial attempt and landed myself inpatient on an adolescent psychiatric unit voluntarily, because fortunately at 17 years old, my parents couldn't sign me in. So otherwise it would have been involuntary. I never would have consented to that. And I got faced with the fact that what I was doing was harmful, that it had to stop, that I couldn't keep living that way. I wish I could say that I stabilized immediately after that, but that's just not the case. You know, I did have a good period of time there where I was fairly stable. That was my senior year, so I graduated shortly thereafter. And I went off to Pitt. I went off to Pitt, Maine. That was always my goal. I wanted to go to Pitt. I wanted to go to pharmacy school. I got conditional acceptance to the pharmacy program, which was a pretty coveted spot. And I started off freshman year strong. I was on the leadership floor at Lothrop Hall. I had my own sink. I had a private room. It was amazing. I made some incredible girlfriends. And I was also drinking very, very heavily. I always go back and forth with this because I was experiencing bad depression at that time. And those nights with my friends drinking were maybe the thing that kept me alive during that time. And I especially say that because I, unfortunately, my freshman year had a classmate who was on my floor, who was down on the other end. We had girls on one side and boys down on the other end, who completed suicide about 3 weeks into the semester. And it was just devastating for every person, I think at Pitt even. I mean, it was just a very difficult thing. And, you know, we went the whole floor, we all went to his viewing, and I just remember that being such a moment of realization for me, that what this impact does to people's lives and what this looks like. And while I still endured ideations after that, I never again had a plan because of that very close witnessing of that event. Now, towards the end of my freshman year, I reconnected with my now husband, and we dated for a period of time. But truthfully, at that time period, I was not in alignment with the person that I am. And it was very rocky. And after some time, we decided to separate. Now, I say we decided to separate, but he broke up with me and I was devastated. I had all kinds of stories about what that meant about me, and I completely spiraled at that point, down to what I consider to be my rock bottom. So I got faced with a dilemma going into my sophomore year of college. I had signed up for an apartment that I essentially couldn't afford. I grew up in poverty. You know, my parents worked the best that they could, making as much money as they could, but they sacrificed college for us. You know, they didn't further their education. They were raising children. And I didn't have resources, and I didn't have money to make up for the difference between the maximum federal loan and the apartment that I wanted on campus. So I was faced with a dilemma where I needed to come up with a lot of money really fast. And I had a friend who told me that if I needed to make money, she knew where I could go to make as much money as I needed. And that's when I started exotic dancing. I started making a lot of money really fast, and I had no idea what I was doing with any of it. I originally was pretty much just using alcohol, and very rare occasions I would do a pill. Once I started dancing, I fell headfirst into all the heavy stuff. You know, I will say this, when it comes to dancing, sex work is real work. Those girls are there to make money, and they deserve to be treated with respect and with dignity as they're making money. I am asked sometimes why I would not continue that work, or why I don't continue that work. And for me, the answer is simple. Sex is recreational, not work for me. I don't have any desire to do that type of work because for me, it was mentally exhaustive. I try to live with integrity, and in the work, sometimes innately, there's some amount of manipulation. at that point in my life, like rewind to when I was actually doing it, I was lying, cheating, stealing. I didn't care. I blatantly led people on to believe that I had intentions that I had no intentions of, just using people. It's not impossible to make money in the field without doing that, I guess. But it's so much easier to make money if you just do it that way. So take that for whatever that means. At any rate, I soon became homeless because I didn't get the apartment on campus. I didn't save up enough money to hand it over in a chunk to the university. I spent it all too quickly. So instead, I got an apartment off campus, which was fine. It was just like a 10-minute bus ride into campus. But I stopped showing up to campus after a while as I continued to fall further and further into the darkness of depression. I eventually lost that place. I couldn't afford it anymore. I was couch surfing. Friend's house. I had completely isolated myself from my family for the most part. I remember just them desperately pleading with me, "Courtney, please, what are you doing? This isn't you." And I had so many excuses. I think probably the best one is the intellectualization that I did. So I used to tell people that for every drug that I did, it expanded my consciousness. And so that's why I had to try all the drugs. So FYI, you can expand your consciousness other way, folks. You don't have to do drugs. But just a great example of where Courtney was at that point. So, eventually, I just bottomed out. Like, I don't know how else to say it. Everything and everyone, I mean, I had conflict in my life that was just overwhelming. At one point, I threw a full wine bottle at one of my best friends over just drugs and money and... It was so empty. Initially, I think I started using drugs and things to feel something good, right? But then at some point, it's like you just desensitize. It's like you feel too much all the time. And then suddenly you feel nothing. And it's just this emptiness and this void. And the drugs, they work, but they only work as long as you're on them. And then as soon as you come off, the world's just a black hole still. And I just couldn't go on like that. I'd be lying if I said I remembered all the details of the dream, but it all ended one day when I woke up from a dream and I was crying. I just was sobbing. And there was just this part of me that just said, "This isn't for you. You have a higher purpose. You have to get out of this place." And that was the point where I finally said okay to all the people who wanted to help me, that I had kept out, that I had pushed out, that wanted me, just for me, to be happy. I said, okay. And I moved back home. I moved back to the Greensburg area. I moved in with my sister and my nieces, and I started again. I picked myself up. I went back to school. I had taken... Basically, it ended up being 2 semesters. It was like I took the whole year off. But I re-enrolled. There were a lot of repercussions for it. You can't just not show up to class, folks. I didn't even withdraw. Like, I just, like, stopped going. Not advisable. Not advisable. I think I paid for that entire semester. Still. That's what depression does, right? That's what it does. Makes you just not give a shit at all. So I had to make up for all of that. I had a lot of hard work I had to do. I ended up having to, for my last two semesters of college, my undergraduate, I had to do 18 credits. Now, once I moved back home and I got my head on straight a little bit and got my bearings, I reconnected with my now husband and we had gotten serious. I was very close with his family and was living with them for a little while as I finished up school. I was working my butt off. I had a 25 to 30 hour a week job, working out in the city, working with people with autism, intellectual disabilities. Like I said, 18 credits. I was a teaching assistant. I was a research assistant. I was doing an internship. Just really pushing myself harder than I ever had in my life. And I was in the process of applying for grad programs. I had a couple of different programs that I had been looking at, but my dream program was in Wilmington, UNCW, University of North Carolina, Wilmington. I applied, I had the interview, they offered me a scholarship. It was all amazing. And then I realized I was late and found out we were pregnant. And at that point, I was just so in love with my boyfriend. And I knew that, like, I wanted this baby. Like, I wanted a healthy, happy little boy. I had a miscarriage earlier in our relationship that really hurt. And all I wanted was a healthy baby. So I gave up that dream, which was okay. I lived with that choice. Oh, I gave up UNCW too. That one hurt. It hurt. But yeah, it was just, I found out I was pregnant right before the start of my last semester of my undergraduate. I remember, I was a research assistant, so I'm working in the lab, okay, running projects, and I remember laying on the floor after I would get the people settled into the room. I would lay on the floor with the two-way mirror next to the trash can and listen for the door to open and shut when they were done because I was just so sick from morning sickness and stuff. But I got it done and I graduated summa cum laude and I was so proud of myself. I was so just in love and over the moon. But with the birth of my son, I realized for the first time in my life the importance of health, of physical health. All of that work had taken a toll on my body. Whether or not I cognitively admitted it to myself, I was under a lot of stress, and that takes a toll. So with the birth of my son, I labored for 4 days. I was so, so sick afterward. I felt like I got hit by a train. I hemorrhaged post-cesarean. I almost went septic. I developed a uterine infection and I had a temperature of like 106 or something. It was absolutely insane. I required blood transfusions. I mean, it was awful. The birth itself was traumatic for me. And those first few years of motherhood really were all about self-sacrifice and unnecessary sacrifice for me. I never went anywhere. I never did anything. You know, my whole world revolved around taking care of my family and work. And not that there's anything wrong with taking care of your family or work, but I mean, I'm a person too. And it took me a while to get to that point. You know, shortly after We were married, and then we welcomed our little girl. We planned to get pregnant right after our wedding so that I could have my little baby between semesters, because I was in my grad program then, because I had my son, and then I, you know, went to grad school around here locally, went for social work instead of behavior analysis, and hey, it all happens for a reason. But at any rate, I welcomed our little girl and had the worst postpartum depression. She was so perfect. And I had mentally been prepared, I think, based on what I had to do through my undergraduate for what it meant to be a mother in a graduate program. But at the same time, I was also losing a huge figure in my life. We found out that his mother was sick with cancer a few years before our daughter was born, and she quickly deteriorated after Madison was born. So I was caring for her too. I was helping to care for her, caring for my newborn in the graduate program, and something inside of me just couldn't do it anymore. I had debilitating depression, constantly, you know, having to turn in papers late. I couldn't hardly function. I was overeating all the time. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong, because it's like, I'm doing everything right. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing here. I'm taking care of my family, but why am I still just so unhappy? And for the first time in my life, I realized that I mattered. So I did what I felt like was very selfish thing at that time. I was given the opportunity to go to a women's leadership retreat through the university that I was attending. And I took the opportunity. I said, yeah, I'm going for a few days. I started listening to podcasts about female empowerment, women's empowerment. I was listening to what was then called the Mom Was in Control podcast, and learned about, you know, fear and guilt, and how it was really just a way of keeping us safe, and that we as women kill ourselves to be good wives and mothers, and how really important it is for us to be models instead of martyrs. And you know, I read all the books. I read Untamed by Glennon Doyle. You know, I read Dying to Be a Good Mother by Heather Chauvin. I dived into her program. I did her mastery program and finished up grad school so, so strong. Now, granted, I graduated in 2020, so this was just a couple months after the pandemic had really begun. You know, at the same time, I had done a huge lifestyle change too. I had completely shifted the way that I ate. I had started exercising. I did the exercising, I would say, a few years prior to that, because how I looked kind of was always more important than how I felt. And I do know that I was working out around the time of my wedding, and that was before my daughter's birth. But it was really in 2019 that I made that shift and started taking care of my physical body. And I felt such a shift mentally that I thought that, oh my God, all I needed to do was just change the way that I took care of my body. And now I'm never going to be depressed again. I'm, you know, like I like overcame this, so to speak. And, you know, I did for quite some time, really. I think that my longest period without depression was close to 2 years. So pretty much from the end of 2019 until close to the end of 2021, I did not really have any depressive episodes. It was pretty consistent for me. I, however, towards the end of 2021, did have a pretty serious depressive episode that led me, actually, though, to one of the most beautiful transformations I've had in my careers. So I had been working inpatient medical. I was helping cover part of the COVID unit. It was very dark and heavy times for me, and I knew that I needed to make a shift. I had always told myself that because I struggled with mental illness meant that I couldn't be a good therapist. Yet somehow I had become everybody's unofficial therapist anyways. I have always been the person that people come to in their darkest moments. I'm always that person that people come to and they're just like, Courtney, I don't know what to do, or can you help me with this, or can I just talk this through with you? And it was so apparent that I needed to go that route and just allow myself to bloom in that way. And it really came down to my therapist looking at me one day and saying, Courtney, did it ever occur to you that having mental illness might give you some wisdom or insight into treating mental illness? And I'm like, yeah, you know, you might be right there. So I took the leap. I took the leap of faith. I jumped into a whole nother career trajectory. I have had so many synchronicities along this journey so far. And I've just had such a rewarding experience in treating patients and working with mental illness and in being the light in the dark place and being willing to just sit with people in the darkness. Because here's the thing, I truly thought that I beat it because I was like eating healthy and exercising and taking care of myself. And maybe this is just my experience. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some people really truly do beat depression and it's just gone forever. But for me, what I found is that sometimes it happens, and it's not because there's something wrong with me. The world is the world is the world. And it's hard sometimes, I think, to be somebody who's very aware, and things are sometimes depressing. Like, life is sometimes depressing. But I will say this, I have not lost my functioning through those depressive episodes. I've been able to maintain through that. And in periods of anxiety where my anxiety is heightened, I have been able to co-create with it. A good example of this is with the Ukraine war. It really impacted me. I'm a very empathic person. When all of that happened, I couldn't sleep, right? I had a very difficult time. And just dealing with the fact that mentally there are people who are just being murdered, like by the thousands on the other side of the world for basically no reason other than Putin's an asshole. And that we just allow this to happen in our world. And so much anxiety around all of this. But instead, I was able to take that energy and channel it into helping to organize a vigil for Ukraine. We were able to raise funds. We were able to, you know, make a beautiful little memorial. And I just think that there are so many aspects to anxiety and depression and things like that, that we forget that this is all nuanced. And, you know, depression, what if it's just this beautiful time that your life is inviting you to slow down? And when you don't want to open up, to open your heart more. And I think that if there was a way, of course, to stop it, that would be great and that would be lovely. But there's no way to stop, like, the seasons, for example. You just can't stop things from passing through life sometimes. But we don't weep for the leaves as they fall every autumn. We know that sometimes leaves fall and that these are periods of time that come. And how do I co-create with this energy? How do I make it through? I mean, there's beauty in the darkness too. People forget that. There is something to be said about what that can reveal to you. Some things are not possible without that. Think about the caterpillar, right? As it is getting ready to become a butterfly, it has to hang upside down and allow itself to be devoured by complete darkness as the chrysalis forms. Imagine what that experience would feel like for it. It probably feels like its whole world is caving in. And that's sometimes the process that life needs to take. And we may experience depression from time to time. We may experience anxiety from time to time. It's part of living for many people. I don't suffer from depression and anxiety. I live with depression and anxiety. And I also live with joy and happiness and peace and acceptance for life in its fullness along the spectrum, every aspect of it. I'm loving and receiving. So I will sit with my patients in the darkness. I will help be the light for them. When it comes to practical tools, one of the things that I do not want to neglect mentioning here is the important role of spirituality in my life. Now, I have endured a lot of religious trauma as a result of having been part of the fundamentalist group for as long as I was. However, spirituality and religion are not connected in my mind. They can be for certain people, but I know atheists who are spiritual. Spirituality is really about the sense of connectedness, belongingness. For some people, it's connectedness to a higher power. For other people, it might be connectedness to nature. But spirituality and that feeling of connectedness has been such a powerful healing tool for me. I meditate, I pray, I journal and channel messages. I am constantly asking the universe and inviting the universe with my energies and with my vibes. I do tarot. I like to dabble into the moon cycles and understanding the moon cycles. I love astrology because I feel like it's been such a healing part of my understanding of why my journey is the way that it is. It's quite literally written in the stars, my journey. And I was meant to be this person. And I could not be in the place that I am today, doing the work that I do, impacting the lives that I impact, had it not been for those experiences that alter me. So I believe that with the right tools, with the right help, with the right support, everybody can be propelled along their healing journey. Healing happens in the right conditions. When you have the right resources and the right supports, that's when it happens. I was blessed along that journey by people who believed in me way before I ever believed in myself. And I just hope that people know that healing can happen at any time. Anytime. So, I hope that you enjoyed my story. If you heard a part of your story in my story, if I've inspired you, if I've impacted you, let me know. I am a Leo, a stellium, guys. I kind of like the attention. No, I'm just kidding. But please, for real, reach out. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen to this. And if you know somebody who's taken a journey of non-linear healing, reach out to me. I'm looking for fellow podcasters or therapists, coaches, mentors, people with stories that inspire you. I would love to feature them here on the podcast. Hey, if you've never been featured anywhere and you're ready to tell your story, reach out too. Let's talk. I believe that sharing stories is how we break stigmas. This is how we come together and heal as in community. So I want to thank you for being part of this community and for joining us today on Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brock.